variant QFT than in quantum gravity in the end. But I just wanted to give you a flavor of what I'm doing with my collaborators, Klaus Feinhagen and Romeo Brunetti, and basically say what I think we can learn about quantum gravity starting from the quantum field theory side. Now, this is a very sketchy presentation, so I try to avoid technical details. But if you have, if there is something unclear, I'm going too fast, please ask questions, because then you can adjust the speed to your speed of understanding. And again, if I'm saying something too obvious, I can also go faster. And if you need more technical details, I will use the board to fill in all the gaps. So please do ask questions. All right. So let's see if it works. Oh, it works. So first, after a short introduction into the framework which I'm using, I will briefly tell you how we construct models in locally covariant quantum field theory and how we can apply it to perturbative quantum gravity. So first, something which you all already know, but it doesn't hurt to repeat it. So there are some difficulties in quantum gravity which make it challenging for a quantum field theorist. So first, usually in quantum field theory and curved spacetimes, one thinks about some fixed background, and quantum fields are living on some fixed background spacetime structure. Now, in quantum gravity, that's not the case, because the spacetime structure itself is dynamical. So we require something like background independence. So I will come to this later, what it means in our framework. Now, related to that, we don't have really meaning attached to points of space steps, because we have this huge symmetry. We have the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. So you would have to take also this into account. And finally, there is this known problem that quantum gravity is power counting non-renormalized. So it seems a bit hopeless, but there are some ways around at least some of these problems. So first, about the non-renormalizability, we can use the so-called Epstein-Glaser renormalization scheme, and I can talk about it a bit more at the end if you wish to know more about it. So it allows to treat quantum gravity as an effective theory, and it allows to obtain finite contributions, finite corrections for every order of perturbation theory. So, this is what we can do for now. In the future, we hope that we will be able to study the structure of a normalization group for quantum gravity and make contact with the asymptotic safety program, maybe show the existence of a UV fixed point. But this is rather like a program for the future. Okay, now about the dynamical structure of spacetime, this can be solved in the framework of locally covariant quantum field theory. So I will show you in this talk that we can look at basically at all backgrounds at the same time. We can look at all backgrounds simultaneously. And although we make a split into a background metric and perturbation, it turns out that the algebraic structure which we get doesn't depend on the split. So this is what we would call background independence. And finally, there is the huge symmetry group, the diffeomorphism group. And to take care of this, we use the so-called Batalin-Wilkowinski formalism, which is a method used in gauge theories, in quantizing gauge theories, which allows to treat symmetries also in the case of gravity. And there are, of course, some technical complications. So first of all, the manifold which we are working with is Lorentzian and non-compact, while the symmetry group is infinite dimensional, the whole diffeomorphism group. So there's a lot of technicalities coming with this, but in the end, it turns out that this can all be solved, and this formalism applies also to gravity. Okay, so this was the outline of our idea, of our framework, and now let me come to some details. So we start with a very basic intuitive idea. So we want to probe the geometrical structure of space-time, first a bit classically, by making local observations. So the word local will appear quite often in what I'm going to say. So this approach is very strongly relying on the locality. So we have the following data. So M is our big space-time, and we have some compact region O where we can make our measurement. And well, then we have to choose what we measure. So we choose a classical observable. And related to the experiment uncertainty, we have some smearing. So we don't want to measure, let's say, scalar curvature at a point, but we want to measure something which will be the curvature smeared with a test function. And this test function somehow models our experimental setup. And it also provides us the localization, so it tells us where exactly our experimental apparatus is localized. So let's once again recall the data which we have. So again, another thing which we can do if we want to measure something like gravitational waves, this is how it's usually done. We think about the background, which is fixed, which we understand, and say measuring a gravitational wave would be measuring the perturbation of this fixed background, which we understand. So at least in this experimental setup, we can tentatively split the metric into the background and the perturbation. So this is the setting which we have in mind. So this is the data which we associate with our experiment. So there is the region where we measure. There is some background metric G. There is a test function which models our experimental apparatus. And this whole thing will assign a number, the result of the experiment, to a given field configuration H. So if we don't see any gravitational wave passing through our measuring device, then H is zero. And if there is some, then we see a signal and we get some non-zero number from this. Okay, so that's the idea. And now I want to talk about diffeomorphism invariance for the theory with this data, which I understand as follows. So,
question?
Yes?
How do you operationally tell the detector the difference between the background and the perturbation?
Operationally? Well, I mean, in the end, I showed that the structure I obtain is independent of how I make the split. So this is, I would say, this is just the motivation. But in the end, the theory is independent of what goes into the background and what goes into the perturbation. Sorry?
The measurement is independent also of the split.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's, I mean, if the theory would be dependent on the split, then it wouldn't make sense.
Good.
All right, so, and now I think about diffeomorphism transformation, which means, well, if I now move my experimental setup to a different region of space-time, can I somehow relate the results which I got there from the results which I have here? So I want to understand what's happening with my observable. So this will come later. And now, a few words about the framework itself. It's inspired by the so-called algebraic quantum field theory, which is an axiomatic framework due to Hack and Hassler. And I want to say a few words about this framework because we are using language coming from the theory. So a quantum field theory model is defined by associating to each space-time region an algebra of observables which we measure in that region. So we can think of, let's say, particles, momenta, positions, whatever we want to measure in the quantum experiment. And for each region, we can think of all the possible observables that are localized in this region. And now there is a certain condition which somehow incorporates the notion of subsystems. So if we have a larger region, then we don't want to lose observables if we go to a larger region. So if I can measure something in this room, if I go out, I would still expect that I will be able to measure the same thing because I don't lose information by just making the region bigger. So this requirement is encoded in the condition that the algebra associated to the smaller region, so this is the one here on the right, is contained in the algebra associated to a larger region. So bigger region, more observables. And the mathematical structure which follows is a net of algebras. And there are some assumptions we can make about these algebras. So usually we assume that they are unital, have involution, and in the original framework we also assume some more strict operator properties, but this is not relevant for this talk. Okay, and now I want to generalize it to arbitrary embeddings of Lorentzian manifolds. So here, this was originally this was all done on Minkowski spacetime. So this O1 and O2 were subregions of the Minkowski spacetime. And now, if I think of quantum field theory and curve spacetime, I want to be able to embed actually various Lorentzian spacetimes into each other. So the framework which allows for this is the locally covariant quantum field theory. And this is, again, just one step farther than the previous slide. So in the previous slide, we had inclusion of subsets of something fixed. And here I allow for inclusion of spacetimes from a certain class. And this class is the globally hyperbolic spacetimes. Being globally hyperbolic means basically that it contains the Cauchy surface. Right, so I consider the class of all globally hyperbolic spacetimes, and I consider embeddings of such spacetimes. Now, not all the embeddings are good, so there is some structure coming with the spacetimes which I want to preserve under embeddings. So first, I want them to be isometries. Then I want them to preserve orientation. And I want them to preserve the causal structure. And maybe this needs a bit of an explanation. So what does it mean here to preserve the causal structure? So the idea is that if I have, can I move here? Does everybody see? Yeah. So if I have one spacetime M embedded into a larger one, I tend to draw double cones because they are nice globally hyperbolic spacetimes. So this is psi. This is the image of M under psi. Sits here. And now, if I consider a causal curve which starts and finishes within this image, so there is a gamma from A to B to psi of m such that gamma of A and gamma of B are in psi of m. This is causal. Then I require that the whole curve is contained within that region. So then gamma of T is also in this image for all T in this interval AB. So this is the condition. And this would be violated. So this would be this curve in M. So this would be violated if I would have a curve going out and going back again. So this is not allowed by this condition. And to give you maybe some more concrete example of what's not admissible, if I have a torus and if I want to embed a double cone into a torus, I'm not allowed to do something like this. So I cannot wrap my this is very hard to draw, actually. I cannot wrap my double cone around the torus so that the back end lands over, so that one edge is over the other edge. Because if I would do something like this, then I would get a causal curve which connects 2 points of this double cone, which was originally not a causal connection within this smaller space. So there is some structure of embeddings, and as I said, the thing which I want to preserve under this embedding is the causal structure. All right. If I then want to build a model of quantum field theory on this class of globally hyperbolic spacetimes, then I will assign to each of the spacetimes a certain algebra, again seen as the algebra of observables in this spacetime. And if I have an embedding of two spacetimes, which is here denoted by psi, then I assign to it a psi, which is the inclusion of algebras. So this again is the notion of subsystems in this language. So the generalization is that instead of having subregions of fixed spacetime, now I have the whole class of globally hyperbolic spacetimes. And this association, this assignment of algebras to spacetimes, has to be done covariantly. And this is an important condition. Actually, this covariance can be mathematically formulated in the category theory language. And here I will allow myself for one slide about category theory, because I cannot really resist. I find this formulation very elegant. Now, this is not very, I don't want to go very abstract, this is not so far away from what I was saying up to now. So if you don't feel comfortable with categories, just remember that a category is essentially a certain class of objects together with maps between them, which we call morphisms. And here, there is two categories which we consider. So The first one is the category of globally hyperbolic spacetimes. So objects are all the spacetimes, and the morphisms are these admissible embeddings, which I was talking about. And the other category is the one of observables, and it contains some topological unital algebras as objects and maps between them as morphisms. So this is the setup. And now, what does it mean to be covariant? Yes?
What is a topological algebra?
Oh, it's an algebra which is also a topological space, and algebraic operations are continuous. So addition is continuous and multiplication by a scalar is continuous. So, in the original framework, we would have Banach algebras, for example, which is in particular a topological algebra with a norm. All right, so the covariance property is first that this assignment of algebras to spacetimes can be then written in terms of such a diagram. So if we map M1 to M2, then if I assign the algebra A of M1 to M1 and then go with this embedding A of psi, it's the same as if I go first to the larger spacetime and then assign the algebra of observables. So this is somehow a very natural condition. And now covariance is the compatibility with composition of maps. So if I have three spacetimes, I embed M1 into M2 into M3, then I have also the compositions of these embeddings. So I have psi prime composed with psi, which goes from M1 to M3. And I want this to be compatible with the maps for the algebras. So this is essentially the covariance. And there is another property which tells us that identities between this space identity, so right, that the identity map which maps spacetime to itself is then also maps to the identity on the algebras. So these are very basic requirements. And moreover, we want two other axioms. We want two other properties of this assignment of algebras to regions, which are also physically motivated. So the first is the causality, which is also called Einstein causality. And it should incorporate the idea that you cannot exchange information between regions which are causally disjoint. So in other words, if you make observation in causally disjoint regions, then the corresponding observables should commute. And this is written in the following way. So I have A of M1, which is the algebra of a region M1, and A of M2, which is the algebra of observables in M2. And if they can, if an M1 and M2 are embedded into a spacetime where they are causally disjoint, then I want this corresponding algebras to commute. So I can draw another picture. So I have here M1, I have M2, and they both go into a larger spacetime. Here's psi 1 and psi 2. And if they are causally disjoint in this larger spacetime, then I want the corresponding algebras to commute. This is the causality. And there is another property.
Excuse me?
Yes.
What does it mean that algebras commute? Elements in the algebra
commute? Yes. Right. So it means exactly what's written there. So for all A1 in, what was that? Alpha psi 1 of A of M1 and A2 in alpha psi 2 of A of M2, we have commutator of A1 and A2 is equal to 0. So the set of all the elements which are commutators between all elements of A1 and A2 is just the 0. Just one element set with 0. And this commutator is understood in the sense of this larger algebra A of M. So first I want to embed them into a larger algebra A of M, and then I look at the commutator and see that it's 0 for all the elements. This is the causality. Now, the time slice axiom is something related to the well-posedness of the Cauchy problem. So classically, if we have a globally hyperbolic spacetime and we have hyperbolic equations, then we can obtain solutions in all the spacetime just knowing the initial Cauchy data on the Cauchy surface. And there is a corresponding relation also in quantum theory. So if I have a neighborhood of a Cauchy surface embedded into my spacetime, then the algebra associated, I might be not clear with the notation. So what I here denote by alpha psi is the same as A on psi. So this is the algebra morphism corresponding to psi. So if I have the algebra of my Cauchy surface, the neighborhood of my Cauchy surface, then it's isomorphic to the algebra of the whole spacetime. In other words, I can reconstruct all the information about my spacetime, about the algebra of this whole spacetime, from the information from the data which is in the neighborhood of the Cauchy surface. This will be useful later on. And these are the axioms. So first is the covariance, second is the causality, and third is the time-space axiom. And now, of course, the question is how we can build models which satisfy these axioms. And this can be done in various ways. And one of these methods is the so-called functional approach. And now I want to say a few words about this approach. Are there any questions about what I said up to now? This is a good moment for a break. Okay, so I can move on to building models. So the main idea is to start with the classical theory, which we know and control very well, and then quantize it by the so-called deformation quantization and introduce the interaction using renormalization. So the first step in my construction is always constructing classical theory, constructing classical observables, and then by some deformation, I get from them the quantum observables. So here, if I want to look at the metric perturbation as my configuration field, then my space of configurations is just sections of the tensor product of the cotangent bundle with itself. So these are just these are just two forms. And my classical observables are functionals on the space of the configurations. So to given configuration, they assign a number which is seen as the result of the measurement of this observable in that given configuration. So then I can do the standard construction from classical field theory, where the dynamics is defined by a certain Poisson structure. This is like the canonical formalism. Then I use the deformation quantization to construct the quantum algebra, essentially by replacing the Poisson brackets with the commutators. All right. And the advantage of this approach is that what we change is not the set of observables, but is the algebraic structure on this set. So we have the same names, the same labels for observables in the classical and in the quantum theory, which helps us to identify the observables in quantized theory and give them some physical interpretation. So it's easier to trace what are the quantum corrections to certain physical quantities. All right. Now, there are some subtleties, and if you want, I can talk about it later. So main obstruction is the fact that the space of field configurations is a bit infinite dimensional. So taking all the functionals on this would not make much sense. It's far too big and also doesn't have a clear interpretation. So we will look at some special class of functionals on the configuration space, which we can easily interpret. Well, smoothness is a bit technical assumption. What's physically important is, again, the locality condition. So I'm primarily interested in observables which are local in the sense that they depend on the configuration via its value at the point and the values of all the derivatives. So in the mathematical language, this local functionals can be written as integration of some compactly supported function on the jet bound. So an example here would be perhaps in place. So an example of such a local observable would be, let's say, the scalar curvature of g plus h, and then integrated with the invariant measure of g plus h over the whole space. So this is local. All right. And since I'm talking about local, I also want to say something about localization. So how do I assign these observables to regions of space then? And here the idea is the following. So I look at a point of my spacetime, and I want to know if my given functional is sensitive to fluctuations of my configurations in the neighborhood of that point. So if I have some fixed configuration and I looked at the perturbation which is supported in the neighborhood of that point, my functional should see the difference. And mathematically, it can be written in the following way. So the support of a functional is a subset of M, which consists of all neighborhoods of, so X is in this support of the functional. If for all the neighborhoods of X, F sees the difference when we perturb configuration by something which is supported in this neighborhood. So this way, we can say that a certain observable is localized in a given region. And we will, yes?
So I'm not sure it makes sense. And if you really want to have general relativity, then
yes.
You move this point x around.
Yeah, that's just the definition of the support. So observables won't be supported at a fixed place.
Yeah. So I would think that, like in your example, the only thing
yes.
that you could write is basically something which is integrated over all of X.
Yes. Yes. Sorry.
So
yeah, you're right.
In this case,
I should.
Yeah. But now, if you write it in this way,
yeah.
It's not really an observable.
Sorry? It's not what?
It's not an observable if you don't transform F, depending on.
Yes, it's not an observable if I don't transform F. That's right. That's exactly right.
So you might say that F is some maybe physical field?
F? Yeah.
Small F,
I mean, yeah.
Some physical field, like some scalar field. But then the support of F naively would still be all points.
I will come to this in a moment. I'm sorry. I will really talk about this, but I just wanted to put all the definitions.
Uh-huh.
So you don't have to think of it as an observable. Just think of it as a functional and the support of the functional. This is not what's going to be an observable anyway. But I just wanted to make definitions clear. And now there is the answer to your question. So. What we then use as, let's say, observables as physical quantities are not the functionals themselves, which, as Bianca pointed out, cannot be made diffeomorphism invariants because they are supported in fixed regions. But what we use is the so-called locally covariant fields. So in the framework of locally covariant quantum field theory, these fields are used to identify observables in different regions of spacetime. In the case where we don't have symmetries with which we can transform different regions to each other. So in other words, we want to give names, we want to give labels to our observable. So if I measure something in here, and I want to compare it with something which is being measured in DZ in Hamburg, then I want to have a way to say that this is the same physical quantity, although it's measured as well. And this is provided by locally covariant fields. So now there is a way to do it. So in order for this to transform correctly under diffeomorphisms, I have to view a field not as a functional fixed at some point, not as a functional fixed in some given region, but my field is actually a function which assigns me to a test function, some functional. So my field here, if I can change the notation, so my field phi m assigns to a test function this functional, which is obtained by, for example, smearing the curvature with this test function. So in this way, when I act on locally covariant fields with diffeomorphisms, then I also have to move the test function around. So this is related to basically to the definition of a locally covariant field. So let me now go through this definition step by step. So a locally covariant field is then a family of maps. So for each spacetime M, I have a map from test functions to functionals, which is numbered by spacetimes. And this idea that a quantum field is a map from test functions to functionals is somehow a generalization of the Weitmann distribution, the Weitmann operator value distributions. So if I would here have the quantum theory instead of functionals, I would have here quantum operators, then this is something like an operator value distribution. And they have this map, this assignment for each spacetime, and there is some compatibility condition. So the compatibility condition is related again to this embedding structure. So if I embed region O into M, then I can look at the test function supported in O and its push forward in M. And then I can also look at a field configuration which lives in M and compare it with its pullback which lives in O. And now if I have a locally covariant quantum field in O, then it has to be compatible with the locally covariant quantum field in M. If I basically move this pullback on the configuration to a push forward on the test function. So it shouldn't matter if I push forward the test function or pull back the configuration field, should be the same object. And this is actually a very strong condition. So if I want to do quantum field theory on curved spacetime, this is actually a condition which restricts me the randomization freedom very drastically. So for a scalar field, the only randomization freedom, for example, for the randomized stress energy tensor is just given by two parameters, whereas without this condition, this would be huge and very difficult to control. So I don't know if this already answers your question or you want to comment on this.
Part of the trick that you have always the background metric, I guess.
Yes, and the part, I mean, so it's a bit different than the notion of observables, for example, which you have in loop quantum gravity, because this is more like, this would be closer to relational observables. Because, as you said, I mean, I could fix this F using other fields of the theory. So, and then this, of course, would also transform this way. So, a priori, I don't specify what F is. So, F is some test function, and I know how to transform it.
If you would fix F to be some other field, just that in the support of this functional would be the entire manifold up here.
No, I mean, the support.
That's what I'm, you know, so it's
really in the classical theory, this F would model some localizing of my experiment. So,
that I understand, but then if you have lots of diffeomorphisms,
yes,
you say,
but if I have a diffeomorphism, then I act both on the functional and both on the test function.
No, what I'm saying is that just imagine that you say you want to measure something where where I have a scalar field, where my scalar field doesn't vanish.
Imagine
that it could be a bump or something.
Yes.
But then it depends on how you define local observable, because then if you apply a diffeomorphism, then you can move this bump around to everywhere in the
Then I have to also move the phi around.
Yeah.
So this should be the next slide.
Yeah. So that's the question, you know, that's just the problem how we define local.
Yes, and this locally covariant quantum fields, they are covariant, but they are not local. They are not local observables.
Mm-hmm.
So I will come to this right now, I guess. And by the way, this condition is the so-called naturality condition. And again, to people who know category theory, this basically means that phi is a natural transformation between certain functors, actually between D and F, to be precise. But again, essential fact is that we have this family of maps satisfying this property. So now I can look what happens if I apply diffeomorphisms. So I have a diffeomorphism. Actually, here it's more sensible to look at the whole family of diffeomorphisms labeled by different space times, so I can transform all the components in a coherent way. So I have a diffeomorphism alpha m, which maps me the region O to O prime. So it can now pull back f by this diffeomorphism, and I have the corresponding test function which lives in O. And now I can define a transformation of all my locally covariant quantum fields, which is basically the relabeling of the relabeling of my observables using this diffeomorphism. So for each m, I have alpha m, and I can transform the metric using this diffeomorphism, and then I can basically relabel all these maps phi. And this defines me some non-trivial transformation of my locally covariant quantum field. And now, so here there is this little cartoon. So in region O prime, I have phi for this transformed m at test function f and that configuration g tilde. And then at O, I have my phi in the original, with the original label at alpha minus 1 of f and alpha minus 1 of g tilde. So this is the definition of how my diffeomorphism transformation works. And now I use this naturality condition, which was the compatibility condition for my embeddings. And this naturality condition implies that here the right-hand side can be written in the following way, so that the object which I get here assigned to O prime can be identified with something assigned to O, where I moved both the test function and I moved the configuration. So if I do this, then I obtained the following formula for the transformed field. And this is what I called diffeomorphism covariance. So locally covariant quantum fields are transforming covariantly under diffeomorphisms. And now I can also impose a stronger condition. So I can say that, well, actually what I require is that when I relabel all these fields using my diffeomorphisms, I shouldn't see any difference. So a stronger condition would be to say that what's on the right-hand side is actually equal to my original field. So this is a non-trivial condition. And to see that this is actually non-trivial and what kind of objects I obtain, I will look at the infinitesimal version of that. So instead of looking at, yes?
Now, before you go on, Can I just ask a question about your strategy with respect to diffeomorphism?
Yes.
Because you're talking here, everything is about the algebra.
Yes.
You haven't yet mentioned states.
Oh, no, I haven't. I don't want to mention states today. Yes, there is a subtlety with the states as well.
But presumably what
yes.
we want to be invariant
yes.
is the expectation values of the observables in states.
Yes.
We want the diffeomorphisms to act in such a way as to leave invariant the expectation value of the
yes.
observables in states.
Yes. Yes.
So unless you tell us how states transform,
yes.
we don't know what we want.
No, I mean, the point is that in the end, I want states which transform covariantly under diffeomorphisms. So
the transformation of the states will invert the transformation of the inverse.
Yes, yes. So essentially, that's the idea, but it's a bit more complicated technically.
Of course.
So the states will also transform under diffeomorphisms.
So then why do you want the algebra to be invariant?
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not really invariant, it's more like covariant. So let me show you the example. So if I take the scalar curvature smeared with a test function and then integrated with the whole overhauled manifold with the invariant volume form, then this is invariant. So this is a good, this is the example I have on the board, this is an example of the invariant, locally covariant quantum field. But if I would say, take the curvature of the full metric and take the volume form only of the background metric, then this would still be covariant, but it won't be invariant in that sense.
Now, normally we would say
yes.
that the first object is not invariant unless the test function is 1.
Well, no, because this is... I mean, this is a map which assigns to F this functional. I mean, if I transform both the test function and the functional, then I get the same.
So the naive way of saying that is that the test function transforms the diffeomorphism.
Yes. I mean, it's like if I mean the test function is basically just. Taking, I mean, just not to make things too singular, you can just write it as phi of x, you can just write it as a field at the point. And then you would transform the operator, so phi of x, and you would also transform the point under diffeomorphisms. So this is just realizing this idea. This is not, I mean, this is new, but not completely new, because in all the works of Nakanishi, for example, there was the same, basically the same formula for the transformation of operators of fields. But we wrote it in a bit more mathematically elegant language.
But there's just a subtle point that test function can be zero.
Sorry?
I mean, just that f usually it's a test function
yes.
that is compactly supported and so on.
Yes.
But if you put a field there, then it's not.
I don't understand.
I mean, I think in this philosophical direction, it's just that I'm not sure how much you can localize in quantum gravity. You know, that's.
I don't think you localize anything in this way.
Yeah, but
I mean, this is not a local quantity. This
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but usually,
yeah.
you know, so one has to be careful because if you say test function.
Yeah.
Then usually it's understood that F is something locally supported.
Yes, it is locally supported, yes. F is absolutely locally supported.
Then the next sentence you say F is, can be a field.
Can be a field.
Like psi or you know, your quantum field?
Well, that I don't know, I'm sorry. I don't know why F should be a field if it's a function. I mean, it could be obtained as an expectation value of some field, which
really
is locally supported, but I don't really understand your question.
So the problem is if you want to write something completely diffeomorphism invariant.
Yeah, but this is not diffeomorphism invariant in the sense you want to have it. This is diffeomorphism covariant.
Okay.
Because you transform both the test function and the field, and the operator. and the field at this test function. So you transform both f and phi of f.
Yeah, so that's covariant.
That's covariant, yes. Yes, but I mean, there is a non-trivial condition, right? I mean, it does allow only for things which are covariantly constructed
written,
from the metric, yes?
But you have written diffeomorphism invariant, so it's a bit.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it's just a name to distinguish it from being locally covariant quantum field, because not all locally covariant quantum fields satisfy this property. So there is, because this, I mean, this below is a locally covariant quantum field, but doesn't satisfy this property. So it's just a name. Yes, please.
More of a technical point, I guess.
Yes.
So this alpha m, you have one diffeomorphism for every Lorentzian manifold m, right?
Yes.
At the same time.
Yes.
So do you also require those that are suitably those to be suitably compatible among?
No, there's no need. I mean, you can take different. You can take arbitrary family. Usually you would look at what's happening at the fixed space time anyway. So
then how do you know that the transformed phi still satisfies your naturality condition? Or?
Well, it does satisfy it by definition, right? I mean, phi is a locally covariant quantum field, so it does satisfy
the transformed one, the alpha phi.
Yes.
As well.
Yes. Yes, because it's, I mean, transforming by alpha phi just, so right, if I transform m by alpha, by a diffeomorphism, if I transform a Lorentz manifold by a diffeomorphism, I get another Lorentz manifold.
Right.
So there was a component of phi for that transform.
But the naturality condition, if I have now this unembedded, a kind of embedded patch, and I can transform this in an arbitrarily different way.
Yes.
If I don't impose any compatibility.
There is a compatibility condition.
The transformation that I apply.
There is a compatibility condition for phi.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can we otherwise
defer
the technical details for?
Yeah, I think we can.
We have
about
5 minutes left, so we should
Since this is actually the most important part, which I wanted to say anyway, then I can just come to conclusion, and we can keep on discussing later. So, So the main idea of this approach is to use locally covariant quantum fields in the way which are defined here to obtain some information about the structure of the quantized spacetime. And but this just one remark. This condition of pi to be invariant or covariant or whatever you want to call it, this distinguishes basically elements which are constructed covariantly from the full metric. And then after quantization, I would replace this functionals with certain quantum operators, and I can look at the expectation values and, for example, see how the expectation value of this scalar curvature in a given state differs from the classical value. All right, so this I can very well skip. I wanted to say something about background independence, but I don't have time.
But you can have another 5.
I can have another 5 minutes. Okay, then just a short remark. So how to obtain the background, the statement about the background independence. So this is actually not just for quantum gravity, this is for any theory. So using this time size axiom, I can embed the neighborhood of a Cauchy surface to two spacetimes, M1 and M2, such that M1 and M2 will differ by metric perturbation which is supported between these two Cauchy surfaces. So let me see if I have a slide for this. Yes. So I consider space-time M and with metric G and the space-time the same manifold M with the metric G2, which is G1 plus H, and they're just supported between two Cauchy surfaces. So I know from the time series axiom that this algebra associated with N plus is isomorphic to the algebra associated with the whole space term, and the same goes with N minus, because this is also a Cauchy surface. So I can define an automorphism of this original algebra associated with MG1 just by composing this algebra maps, which I obtained by time series axiom. So I go first to this algebra here, then I go to the algebra of M2, then I go to the algebra of N minus, and then I go back to the algebra of M1. So I obtain a certain isomorphism. And then I can look at the derivative of this with respect to this perturbation. So it will tell me how my theory changes if I perturb the background metric by H. And this has an interpretation of the stress energy tensor. And in this language, we have shown that the background independence, so the independence of on the change of this background metric can be obtained algebraically. So first one can show that the derivative of this maps, so the change of a given observable under perturbation of the background metric can be written as the stress energy tensor, as the commutator of the stress energy tensor. So this is this is actually a statement which holds in general for quantum field theories satisfying time slice axiom. And now in the case where we have pure gravity without matter, then this quantity should be zero. So this dependence of my given field on the perturbation of the background metric would be zero. Now, the only thing which one has to check is if this remains zero also after renormalization. So this was also done in our work. Okay, well, that was background independence. So since I expect that there are still some questions, so thank you for the attention.